Arthur Connor held his lantern up in front of him.
What's the matter with you, Ned? Come here.
The dog had started barking at something 15 minutes before, and he wouldn't stop. Arthur finally decided that Ned must have heard something, so he went out to take a look. He had already had a couple of coyotes in the barn this past week trying to get to the chickens. He had taken only a few steps when he was startled by the sudden appearance of a dark figure leading a horse toward him.
Still hard to sneak up on old Ned.
Arthur stopped in his tracks, stunned and confused.
Evening, Pa. I didn't mean to scare you.
Clint? Clint, is that you, boy?
The hand holding the lantern was shaking with excitement now.
Yes, sir. It's me. I didn't want to slip in here like this, but I had to watch the house for a bit before I rode in. I wanted to make sure you were alone.
My God in heaven, I can't believe it's you!
He held the lantern up so he could look at him.
I swear, you don't look none the worse for 3 years in prison. I believe you've grown into a man.
He reached out and gave his son a one-armed bear hug. Then he stepped back.
Wait a minute. Why the hell wouldn't I be alone?
Well, there might be somebody looking for me.
Done come and gone. Sheriff's deputy came out from Cheyenne yesterday looking for you.
You already know I broke out then.
Yeah, I know. Come on, put your horse in the barn and we'll go in the house and fix you something to eat. You hungry? I ain't ever known you when you wasn't.
Pa, I didn't have no intention of breaking out of prison. I was bound to serve my time, but I got caught in a situation where I had to run out with those other fellers or be left behind with a bullet in my head.
You don't owe me no explanation, son. You've always tried to do the right thing, and that includes when you took that Appaloosa from Judge Plover. I don't blame you, no, I never did. They oughtn't to sent you to prison for that. That man ain't fitting to own horses. Come on.
As soon as Clint entered the house, he felt a shiver of emotion run through his entire body as he looked around the familiar scene after an absence of 3 years.
Ain't much changed since you've been gone. Well, I finally built a new table. That's about all, I reckon.
Clint followed his father's eyes to the kitchen table. He nodded, but he didn't comment. His father had threatened to build a new table for years to replace one that wobbled precariously from two mended legs. It was a job that no one had the time to get around to, and one that always caused his father to swear out loud every damn time a cup of coffee or a pan of fresh milk was caused to slop over when someone leaned too hard on one end or the other.
Yep, she's solid now.
Arthur smacked the table with the palm of his hand. Feeling awkward in his attempt to make small talk, he decided to cut right to what he really wanted to know.
How come you broke out, son?
Like I said, I didn't really have a choice.
He then went on to relate the details of his escape with Clell Ballinger and Bob Washburn, and his subsequent split with the outlaws.
Did you kill anybody?
No, sir.
Arthur nodded his head thoughtfully. He was satisfied that as long as Clint hadn't taken anyone's life, he could be forgiven for anything else that might have happened.
Well, what are you planning to do now? Like I said, the sheriff's deputy was already out here. I expect he'll be back. It might go easier on you if you turned yourself in instead of waiting for them to come back looking for you again.
I ain't going back, Pa. I just stopped by to see you before I head up to Montana territory. I aim to lose myself up in the high country, maybe go on to Canada. It'd like to kill me being locked up for 3 years. If I go back now, they're bound to add time to my sentence. I ain't going back.
Knowing it unlikely that Clint's mind could be changed once he had decided upon something, Arthur shrugged to signal the issue settled.
It ain't exactly a good time to be riding up to Powder River country. I don't know how much you heard being locked up in that prison, but there's been a lot of trouble with the Sioux and Cheyenne during this whole last year.
I heard about it. I intend to stay clear of any Indians.
He hesitated a moment before broaching a subject that had bothered his conscience.
Pa, I know you were probably counting on me to help you here when I got out of prison. and I'm sorry I'm not going to be here to do it.
Don't fret about it. I'm doing all right. I've got Charlie Simpson working for me. And to tell you the truth, Charlie ain't good for nothing but ranch work. So I don't know what old Charlie would do if you came back and I had to let him go.
Deciding the matter closed, Arthur went to the stove and picked up the coffee pot, then handed it to Clint.
Yeah, go fill this with some water while I grind up some coffee. I got some cornbread left from supper, and I'll see if I can find something else for you to eat.
I need to swap these clothes I'm wearing for something better. You didn't throw out all my old clothes, did you?
They're in your room, right where you left them.
Good, because I can't wait to shuck these I got on.
After changing into his old clothes, which were a trifle tight across the chest and shoulders now, they talked late into the evening like two old friends instead of father and son. Arthur was aware of the changes in his son that prison had wrought. Whether good or bad, he couldn't say, but there was a sense of quiet maturity that was not in the boy when he was sent to prison. Arthur decided that Clint was doing the right thing. He had no business in prison. Arthur went to bed that night believing that justice had at last been served. Up before sunup, Clint was in the barn saddling his horse when Arthur came from the house.
You leaving so soon?
Morning. I thought I'd get out of here before Charlie comes to work. No need to let anybody know I was here.
Hell, Charlie wouldn't tell nobody. He won't be here till noon anyway. I'd have been up before this, but we stayed up a long time past my bedtime last night.
I wouldn't have been up so early myself, but I guess I was having a hard time getting used to a soft bed again.
Arthur held his lantern up as he looked Clint's horse over, a habit brought on from years of raising horses.
Where'd you get him? Kind of long in the tooth, ain't he?
He's stolen. One of the prisoners I broke out with stole him from the prison corral.
Damn, that ain't good.
I know, but he's all I got right now, and I'll be taking him a long way from here. At least he's better than the one I was riding before him.
He might be all right for a pack horse, and you'll be needing a pack horse.
Well, yeah, but...
I got a horse for you.
His father started toward the corral.
Come on.
A faint streak of morning light snaked over the hills to the east, and Arthur set the lantern down at his feet.
That buckskin Don over there next to the trough. I bought him off a fella about a month ago. He's saddle broke and stout. Got a little bit of rascal in him, too. Plum rowdy sometimes. Day after I brought him home, he was nipping at the other horses in the corral just to see him run around and around. He'll make a fine horse for you.
Even in the dim morning light, Clint couldn't help but admire the horse. But it seemed like an awful lot to expect from his father.
I appreciate it, Pa, but that horse probably cost you a pretty penny, and I can make do with the gray.
There ain't gonna be no discussion about it. You can't go riding off to Montana on that old buzzard bait. Besides, I figure I owe you for that Appaloosa you love so much. If I hadn't sold that damn horse, you wouldn't have gone to prison. I want to get rid of that damn buckskin anyway before he runs the other horses ragged.
Hell, Pa. The reason I got sent to prison was because I did a damn fool thing. It wasn't anybody's fault but mine.
I want you to take the horse anyway.
The horse wasn't the only thing he gained by visiting his father. By the time he left, Arthur had loaded the pack horse with supplies and utensils, as well as insisting that he trade the old model Winchester for his dad's 73 model. It was well past sunup when Clint said his final farewell and pointed the buckskin north. There was a feeling of sadness over leaving his father again, but at the same time, a sense of relief, as if his soul was free to start on a clean slate. He rode away from the little ranch southwest of Cheyenne, well mounted, well armed, well supplied, and with a little money in his pocket. Intending to pass to the east of Cheyenne, he planned to head toward Fort Laramie, possibly following along the route of the old cattle trails that led from Cheyenne to Montana Territory. From there, he planned to follow whatever urge struck him at the time. Happy to be rid of Clell Ballinger and his sidekicks, he could now look forward to discovering a new country where thoughts of prison and outlaws were left far behind him. His father had been accurate in his evaluation of the buckskin dun. The horse seemed willing and strong as the two new partners crossed the railroad tracks east of Cheyenne, and by the time they reached Lodgepole Creek, he was thinking over names for the horse. Remembering what his father had said about the spirited gelding, he decided to call him Rowdy.
Rowdy, I like it.
He patted the buckskin on the neck.
How do you like it? I'm going to consider that a yes.
By mid-afternoon, he felt reasonably certain that he had struck the Shawnee Trail. He was on his way to Montana, unaware of the dark cloud that shadowed him from Colorado. Zach Clayton stuck doggedly to the trail he had followed from Fort Collins. He had held his horse hard to a fast pace, but had not so far gained any ground on Ballinger and Yancey. It didn't discourage him. He knew that he would eventually catch up to him as sure as the sun rose and set every day. He had never failed to run down any man he chased. His patience and determination were well known among lawmen and outlaws alike. The outlaws had stopped to rest their horses on Owl Creek, some 5 or 6 miles south of Cheyenne. Clayton sat on his heels by a burnt-out campfire and stirred the ashes with his finger. They were not that far ahead of him now, judging by the warmth of the ashes.
They rested their horses before moving on.
He spotted their tracks on the other side of the creek, veering toward the east, obviously intending to skirt around the town. He had made up some ground on him, but his horse was in need of rest. He decided on a short rest for his horse, then they could both walk for a couple of hours in an effort to make up a little more ground. He pulled the saddle off and let the sorrel graze while he sat with his back against the cottonwood. He had hoped the two outlaws would ride straight into Cheyenne, where there was always a fair chance they would get slowed down by a saloon, making his job easier. At least their tracks were easily followed. Late afternoon found him saddling his horse again. Picking up the tracks on the east side of the creek, he started out leading the sorrel, figuring he had a few hours of daylight left before being forced to stop for the night. The next morning, as soon as it was light enough to follow the tracks, he was in the saddle again. He found their next campfire around noon, about 15 miles north of Cheyenne. The ashes were still smoking when he stirred them. He was close. He stroked the sorrel's neck.
It's time to make you work a little, boy.
I knew it, damn it. I had a feeling we weren't done with that son of a bitch. I've been in this business too long not to know when I'm being dogged by a lawman.
Ballinger, kneeling by the tiny stream that meandered down through a narrow ravine spotted with sage and berry bushes, wiped his mouth on his sleeve and rose to his feet.
What are you looking at?
That damn Marshal Clayton. Damn it, Clell, I told you he'd be dogging us. I'd bet my share of the money that Clint Connor was the son of a bitch that tipped them off.
Well, you've been looking over your shoulder ever since we left Colorado. You probably drawed him to us, you was looking so hard.
He climbed up to the top of the ravine beside Yancey and looked in the direction his partner pointed.
I expect it's him, all right.
Although the Lone Rider was little more than a tiny figure on the treeless prairie behind him, the feeling in his gut was enough to verify it.
It's him.
He's rode a long way to get killed.
Ballinger turned to look back down the ravine where the horses were drinking.
And this looks as good a place as any. Come on. Better tie the horses to a bush so they don't run off when the shooting starts.
Soon, the two gunmen picked their spots to lie in wait for the unsuspecting lawman at the rim of the ravine. Lying flat on their bellies, they watched as Clayton drew near, waiting for him to come within range.
I got $10 as my shot is the one that hits him first.
You got a bet.
You ain't seen the day you could outshoot me.
Clayton eased his horse back to a slow walk after having held the sorrel to a steady lope for some time. The trail, now leading over a series of cuts and ravines at the base of a low butte, was easily identified because of the tall grass on this side of the hills. There remained two distinct trails left by Ballinger and Yancey, fresh enough so that the grass had not yet recovered. From prior trips in this part of the territory, Clayton knew that this was a small area of tall grass. The tracking might not be as easy on the northern side of the hills, but if he was in luck, he figured he might catch up to them by sundown. Before Clayton had time to react, a second bullet hit the horse's chest. He tried to turn the frantic animal, but the horse's instincts told it to run. It tried to gallop off to one side, but it staggered and stumbled. Clayton came out of the saddle just as the mortally wounded horse crashed to the ground. With bullets ripping the ground all around him, he scrambled quickly to take cover behind his fallen horse. One look at the sorrel's wounds and he knew the horse was gone. Lying on the ground behind the carcass, he looked behind him, then to each side. He had been caught on an open prairie with no apparent cover readily available. His horse was gonna have to do. Pulling his rifle from the saddle sling, he tried to pinpoint the source of the attack. He soon figured out that his assailants were firing from the rim of a ravine about 150 yards away.
I guess I'm just lucky they didn't wait till I got a lot closer.
Damn it, Yancey, why the hell couldn't you wait till he got in decent range? Now we got no choice but to waste a hell of a lot of ammunition trying to get a lucky shot.
Oh, hell, I thought I could hit him. At least we got him pinned down. He can't move from behind that horse.
We could have used that horse.
Well, even if we don't get a shot at him, at least he ain't gonna be dogging us no more. Why don't we just ride on now?
I want him dead, damn it! I don't want to look around a month from now and see that son of a bitch on my tail again.
He ain't shot back once. Maybe one of them shots caught him.
I doubt it. He just got more sense than to waste a lot of cartridges when he ain't got a likely target.
I got that horse sighted in. If that marshal shows his head, I'll get him.
As if cooperating to prove Yancey's point, Clayton eased the rifle over the saddle and took aim at the rim of the ravine. Yancey immediately pulled the trigger, sending a slug to embed in the saddle inches from Clayton's head.
Hot damn! I told you I had him! Let him stick his head up there again!
Clint Connor pulled Rowdy up short, turned his head to face the wind, and listened. Judging from the sound, the gunshots were probably 2 or 3 miles away.
Too many for Hunter. Hell, it's none of my affair.
But Clint found it difficult to ignore when the shooting continued. He remembered his father's warning about Indian activity in the area. Finally, his conscience called upon him to at least have a look to make sure some settler wasn't in trouble. He turned Rowdy's head west. He felt certain the rifle fire was just beyond a gentle rise that almost formed a ridge between him and the source of the shooting. Knowing he would be silhouetted against the blue sky behind him if he rode over the top of the ridge, he dismounted and left his horses there below the rise. Making his way the remaining distance on foot, he dropped to his knees and crawled the final few feet. The first thing he saw was a man lying behind his dead horse, obviously pinned down in the open on a flat expanse of prairie. Scanning back 150 yards or so, he finally sighted the shooters on the edge of the ravine. After another minute, he decided there were two of them. There followed a few moments of hesitation on his part. What he had stumbled upon, he was not sure, but it was obvious who the victim was anyway. Whether he deserved it or not was impossible to say. He decided the only way he might be able to tell who was in the right and who was in the wrong was to get around behind the two riflemen to get a better look. Could be they were Indians and had bushwhacked a man trapped behind the horse. Looking beyond the ravine, he saw that his best chance was to circle all the way around to the base of the hills behind the two shooters. pulling slowly away from the top of the ridge. He stayed on hands and knees until sure he could stand up without being seen. Back to his horses, he mounted and nudged Rowdy forward again. It took fully half an hour to make a wide enough circle to position himself directly behind the bushwhackers in the ravine. He pulled his horses up as close as he dared before leaving them in a narrow gully 50 or 60 yards away. Pulling his rifle, he climbed up to the top of the gully and dropped to the ground to look the situation over. There was nothing but flat open ground between his gully and the ravine, so that was as close as he dared go. He discovered, however, that he had a clear view of the two men lying at the opposite lip of the ravine. They were not Indians. He stared at them for a long moment, still uncertain as to what he should do, if anything at all. Then, as he continued to stare, one of the men rolled over on his side to say something to the other.
Ballinger.
For a moment, Clint was stunned. It was almost too much to believe that in this vast Wyoming prairie, he had once again crossed paths with Ballinger and Yancey. He had thought he would never see the two notorious killers again, having assumed that Ballinger and his cohorts were heading down into Colorado. Recovering immediately, he took another long look. There were only two of them. He searched as much of the ravine as he could see, looking for Skinner, but Skinner was nowhere to be seen. It was a hell of a turn of events, but one thing he felt sure he could assume. The man pinned behind his horse had to be the innocent party, and most likely a lawman after him for robbing the bank in Fort Collins. Without further thought, Clint raised his rifle and sighted it on Yancey. Clint couldn't see where he hit Yancey, but he could see that Yancey was rolling over and over. Clint quickly shifted his aim and pulled the trigger again, but Ballinger moved to the side just in time to cause the bullet to miss. Without a clear target now, Clint cranked round after round into the chamber, spraying the side of the ravine with lead. Caught in a panic of confusion, Ballinger and Yancey scrambled down off the slope.
Let's get the hell out of here!
Ballinger stumbled down to the bottom of the ravine. Yancey, his left arm soaked with blood from a shoulder wound, needed no encouragement. Without knowing who or how many their assailants were, there was no thought beyond escape in the minds of both men. Ballinger and Yancey mounted their horses and took off along the bottom of the ravine.
How bad are you hurt?
Shoulder! I don't know how bad.
They followed the ravine to the point where it widened at its origin on a hillside, then made their way, running the horses flat out through a maze of low, treeless hills. When the horses began to falter from the strain, they were forced to let up on the weary animals. Ballinger looked back over his shoulder.
I don't see nobody. I don't think they saw which way we went.
I say we just keep riding. I need to tend to my shoulder.
The son of a bitch had help. I don't know how they got around us, but we're damn lucky to get out of there.
You were lucky.
Yancey stuffed his bandana inside his shirt to try to stop the bleeding.
They wouldn't have caught up with us at all if you hadn't laid around in your blankets this morning.
Well, I didn't know we were in a by God hurry till we spotted them this afternoon. Hell, I ain't noticed you up so damn early.
Ballinger was staring back the way they had just come.
You see anybody?
We lost them. Let's get moving before they start searching these hills.
Clint stood on the side of the gully, reloading his rifle while watching for any sign of the bushwhackers' return. He waited until he felt sure they had gone before going back for his horses. He was undecided at first about riding down to help the man trapped behind the horse. Chances were he was a lawman chasing Ballinger and Yancey. But what if he wasn't? What if he was an innocent victim of ambush by the two? Even while telling himself that he was a damn fool to do it, he decided to see whether the man was alive or dead. His question was answered when he approached to within 50 yards of the lead-filled carcass. Clayton rose to one knee, watching him carefully before standing up to meet him.
Mister, I'm mighty glad you came along.
You look like you could use a little help.
Clint pulled up beside him and dismounted.
I don't think those two will be back. They lit out towards the west.
I'm much obliged. They left me in a fix.
Zack studied his young Samaritan closely, thinking maybe he had seen his likeness on a poster. Growing more confident in the identification, he casually pulled his vest aside to show his badge.
I'm a U.S. Deputy Marshal. I was chasing those two when they ambushed me.
Is that a fact?
Yeah, there are a couple of bad ones. One of them escaped from the territorial prison a few days ago with two other prisoners. I shot one of them over in Fort Collins. These two took off up this way. They must have split up with the other fellow because he left the night before.
The picture of a lone rider he had passed on the road into Fort Collins one moonlit night came to his mind then, and he had a strong feeling that it was the same man he was now talking to. The thought caused a plethora of conflicting decisions. Clint Connor was not comfortable with the direction of the conversation. He cursed himself for coming to help the marshal, but now he had no choice but to maintain a calm exterior and hope to bluff his way through.
Well, looks like your manhunt has hit a snag for now. I don't like to leave a man on foot out here, so I reckon I could let you have my pack horse to get you back to Cheyenne.
Well, that's mighty neighborly of you, Mr. What was your name?
Smith. I reckon you'll be heading back to get another horse.
Oh, no. My job is to go after those convicts.
He gave Clint a knowing smile.
All of them.
There was an awkward moment of silence while the two stood facing each other.
Now, if I was a betting man, I'd bet that you'd more than likely answer to the name of Connor instead of Smith.
The sudden tightness of Clint's jaw told Clayton that he was right. He was a little reluctant to take the next step since Clint had just gotten him out of a serious situation. There was a series of acts that indicated Clint Connor was a decent man, saving the prison guard's life, the warning note about the bank job, and now his own rescue. In view of all that, he could elect to let him go on his way. But Clayton could not turn his back on his responsibility, and Clint was an escaped convict. It was Clayton's job to bring him to justice, and it was as simple as that. Clint took a backward step toward his horse, and quicker than a lightning flash, Clayton's hand came up, his .44 leveled at him.
Sorry, son, but I'm gonna have to take you in.
Why, you ungrateful son of a bitch. I should have left you lying behind that damn horse.
I understand how you feel, and I appreciate what you've done. I'll mention it to the judge, and maybe he'll go easy on you. But I've got to do my job. It ain't up to me to decide the right and wrong of things.
He motioned with his pistol.
Now take your left hand and unbuckle that gun belt. Do it real slow. I don't want to have to shoot you, but I sure as hell will if you don't do like I tell you.
With no choice but to do as he was told, Clint let his gun belt fall to the ground.
Now you'd best unload that pack horse and put my saddle on him.
Clint said nothing. He went to the pack horse and started working on the straps his father had fashioned. When he had untied one of the large canvas packs, he backed away from the horse, holding the pack in his arms, pretending to look for a place to set it down.
Just drop it on the ground.
It's got flour and such in it. I don't want to spill it.
What do you care? You ain't gonna be using it.
Clayton stepped forward and reached out to jerk one end of the pack out of Clint's hands.
Drop the damn thing.
In one swift move, Clint shoved the canvas sack into Clayton's chest, launching his body after it. Clayton's reflexes caused him to pull the trigger. But the thrust of Clint's shoulder drove Clayton's arm down, and the bullet went into the ground between them. Clint grabbed Clayton's wrist before he could bring the pistol to bear again, and he drove him to the ground. As Clayton landed, the pistol fell from his grasp. Clint quickly grabbed it and leveled it at Clayton.
Now we're gonna sing the same song, but with a different verse. Pick up that pack and tie it on again.
You're making a hell of a big mistake.
Clayton took the opportunity to stand back up.
I believe you're the one who made the mistake, seeing as how I'm the one holding the gun. Now hurry up and tie that pack on.
You ain't a killer. You're not gonna shoot me. So why don't you just hand over the gun?
Clint stood gazing at the cocksure lawman for a long moment.
Maybe you're right.
Before Clayton could form the confident smile he intended, Clint struck him hard on the chin with the weapon. He knocked him to the ground.
Now get up and do what I tell you. And make no mistake, I will shoot if I have to.
Clayton took a minute to clear his head before climbing to his feet, a more subdued man. Clint took the opportunity to quickly buckle on his gun belt again. When the pack was secure once more, Clint picked up Clayton's rifle and stepped up in the saddle.
You're the one who chose to play the game this way. I paid enough for the mistake I made 3 years ago, and I'm not going back to that prison. It's about 15 miles back to Cheyenne. Just a good stretch of the legs.
He glanced around, looking for a spot.
See that low mesa over there? I'll leave your guns over near the base of it.
You'd best shoot me if you don't want to see me again, because I'll hunt you down if it takes the rest of my life.
Mister, I hope you got better things to do with your life.
Clint's first camp after leaving Marshal Zach Clayton on foot was beside Horse Creek. It was not lost on him that he was no more than 40 miles or so from the Wyoming Territorial Prison, where he had spent the last 3 years of his life. It was not a comfortable feeling, and he was anxious to get an early start in the morning to be on his way, seeking to leave Wyoming behind him. He thought about his confrontation with Clayton. The deputy marshal should have completed his walk back to Cheyenne by then, and no doubt sent wires to every town that had a telegraph pole. In view of that, he planned to avoid towns of any size. He would cross the Chugwater tomorrow and head northwest, planning to cut between the Laramie Mountains and Fort Laramie. Once across the Platte, he would head in a more northeasterly direction, hoping to avoid Sioux or Cheyenne war parties. 2 days of steady riding found him in camp by the North Fork of the Laramie River, near the base of the rugged Laramie Mountains. Riding up into hills dotted with pines and evergreens, he doubled back to check on his back trail to make sure no one was following him. It was strictly precaution, for he didn't expect to see anyone. But since he had accidentally run into Ballinger and Yancey, he thought it best not to leave anything to chance. It was only after another day and a half, when he crossed the Platte a few miles east of Fort Fetterman, that he discarded his concern over being followed. Turning Rowdy a little more toward the east then, while keeping a general northern course, he rode over rolling grassland with distant horizons in all directions. One man, alone in a seemingly endless prairie, he at last felt free of civilization's restraints. There was no sign of mankind, white or savage. He imagined he felt as Adam had before God sent Eve to keep him company. Maybe the only difference was a wide prairie instead of a Garden of Eden. Joanna Becker paused to listen to a bird calling outside the back window. It was an odd call, she thought, unable to identify the species. Sounded like a meadowlark, but she had never seen a meadowlark in these hills. She swung the large iron pot away from the fire and stirred the rabbit stew with a long wooden spoon. Swinging the pot back over the fire, she paused again when she heard the bird once more. This time on the other side of the cabin.
Want me to set the table?
Joanna looked at her mother. She sat by the window, sewing a patch on her father's shirt.
No, it can wait. Daddy and Robert won't be back for at least an hour yet.
The afternoon was fading rapidly, and soon there would be little light coming through the open window. She gave her mother a smile.
This stew isn't going to be ready before then anyway, as slow as it's cooking.
Her husband, Robert, had told her that morning that he and her father planned to move the box upstream about 100 yards and would probably be home a little later than usual. The two men had been working hard for the past 4 months to get the cabin ready for winter while trying to work a mining claim at the same time. When they came to the Black Hills from Omaha in the early spring, Robert had boasted about the plentiful game close to the cabin. Well, the problem was he never had the time to hunt for fresh meat. So Joanna and her mother had fashioned a trap that had caught the rabbit now simmering in the iron pot. She smiled when she thought about the surprised look she would see on Robert's face when he came home expecting more salt pork.
Robert.
The quest into the Black Hills to search for gold had sounded so adventurous when they started out from Omaha. It had turned out to be an unrewarding labor from dawn to dusk, as the men worked to build a rough cabin while filling a sluice box with colorless dirt. The only other choice had been to go to Montana Territory with her uncle and two other families in hopes of creating a farm community. The search for gold had seemed much more compelling. Joanna honestly believed that had not Robert been excited about the prospect of striking it rich, her father would most likely have chosen to go to Montana with his brother. It made little difference now, though. The die had been cast. Maybe the gold they had hoped to find would be turned up any day now. Trouble in her mind lately was Robert's lack of enthusiasm for almost anything. She guessed that maybe he was just tired. His interest in her seemed non-existent, except on the occasional nights when he felt the need to relieve himself of his anxieties by availing himself of the use of her body. The episode was always short and to the point as he groaned and struggled to keep the noise down in their tiny room next to her parents. Maybe, she thought, if she were not so plain.
There it is again.
What?
That bird, can you hear it? There, hear it? It's on the other side now.
As soon as she said it, a chilling thought came to her mind. With a worried glance at her mother still sitting by the window, she walked over beside her and peered out into the lengthening shadows. She saw nothing at first, but as she continued to stare, she suddenly caught a movement in the shadows, and her heart stopped for a beat.
Robert?
Joanna turned to speak to her mother, but she was startled by the look of terror on the woman's face. She turned then to see the cause of her mother's fright, the painted torso of a Sioux warrior framed in the kitchen window.
Mama.
Joanna turned toward the shotgun over the mantle, but before she could take a step, the door was suddenly flung open and two warriors burst into the cabin. She started to run to the fireplace, but one of the warriors, a solid brute of a man with wide shoulders, caught her by the wrist and threw her to the floor.
Sit!
He glared menacingly while the warrior at the window joined him. Horrified by the specter of the three painted savages crowding into the tiny cabin, both women sat paralyzed while the Indians began plundering the room.
Mazawaka.
The savage who had been at the back window pointed to the shotgun over the mantle. One of the others, shorter than his two friends, nodded and quickly took it from the pegs and examined it, turning it over several times. He grinned at Wide Shoulders, revealing a gap where a tooth had once been. When Wide Shoulders spotted the pot bubbling over the fire, he picked up the wooden spoon Joanna had dropped. Dipping it into the pot, he sampled the stew.
What is this?
Rabbit.
The warrior took another spoonful.
Good.
He motioned for his friends to help themselves. Thinking that maybe they might leave him in peace if shown some kindness, Joanna's mother got up from her chair.
If you and your friends are hungry, we could,
The warrior standing closest to her backhanded her. Joanna tried to get to her feet, but the English-speaking Indian held her down.
Sit!
He gestured with the stone-headed war club he held. She jerked her hand free of his grasp.
How dare you strike a defenseless old woman?
Joanna rose to go to her mother's aid, and Gaptooth drew back to strike her.
Wait!
Wide Shoulders stood watching her as she helped her mother back in the chair.
Mother?
Yes.
Joanna answered while blotting the blood from her mother's face. The woman simply stared straight ahead in shocked confusion, obviously stunned by the viciousness of the blow to the side of her face. Joanna rose to go to the water bucket to dampen the apron she'd been using to clean the blood from her mother's face.
Shit.
No!
She started toward the bucket on the table. He slapped her hard across the cheek.
I say sit!
Staggered, but still on her feet, her face stinging from the blow, she gritted her teeth and thrust her chin out defiantly.
I'll tend to my mother. Now you take your savage friends and get out of my house!
Wide Shoulders' face flushed with fury for a split second before relaxing to form an amused smirk.
I fix mother.
Then, before Joanna could react, he whirled and struck the unsuspecting woman with his war club, smashing her skull. Struck helpless by the horrifying sight of her mother's head recoiling from the blow, Joanna felt her throat choking with a soundless scream that paralyzed her lungs and blocked her breath. She could not stop the darkness that seemed to be filling her brain. When awareness next entered Joanna's brain, she found her hands were tied around the neck of the one horse in her father's corral, and Wide Shoulders was in the process of tying a rope to her ankles beneath the horse's belly. Seeing that his captive was regaining consciousness, Wide Shoulders pointed his war club at her, gesturing,
"You not good. I fix like mother."
Carl Steiner urged his horse up the slope, following his son-in-law through the pines that cover the ridge above their claim. It had been a long day with nothing to show for their efforts, but he was hopeful that the new location upstream would soon show some color. As the horses made their way around the rocky ledges that crowned the top of the ridge, Carl thought about his daughter's husband, whose image was now softened by the growing darkness. Robert seemed to be a nice enough young man, but it seemed to Carl that he had taken to complaining about the work and the lack of instant wealth from the mountain stream. It might have been a mistake to undertake this joint venture with Robert and Joanna. Maybe it would have been better if he and Sarah had stayed in Omaha and let the young folks seek fortunes in the Black Hills. Carl figured he outworked Robert every day. Robert just didn't have the patience to wait until they struck some solid color. Sarah would scold Carl for criticizing Robert. As long as he makes Joanna happy, she always said. Well, as far as Carl could tell, Joanna didn't look particularly happy to him. But he really couldn't blame Robert for that. It had been nothing but long, hard hours ever since they first raised tents on French Creek, only to be escorted out by the soldiers trying to enforce the treaty with the Indians. Like all the other prospectors, they simply moved to another location, playing hide and seek with the army in the Forbidden Hills. He was still optimistic about the little stream they had settled on near the western edge of the Black Hills. His thoughts were interrupted when he realized that Robert had stopped. He pulled even with his son-in-law.
Something wrong?
Robert was peering down through the trees, trying to see through the gloom of the evening.
It just seems kind of strange. Usually smells smoke. You even see a little from the chimney on top of this ridge.
Maybe the wind's just changed.
Carl nudged his horse and started down the ridge in the lead. Although they often saw smoke from the ridgetop, the cabin itself was not visible through the trees until about halfway down. The first clue that something was amiss was when Carl came upon an empty corral. Still, it was not enough to cause him to worry.
Sarah! Joanna!
What?
Robert pulled his horse up in the yard. Carl dismounted.
I said I wonder where the women are.
Becoming more concerned by the moment, he hurried toward the front door, hesitating only briefly to pick up a couple of pieces of calico that lay on the ground, as if someone had dropped them. Robert, now sensing something wrong as well, pulled his rifle from the saddle sling and stayed back while his father-in-law stepped inside the cabin.
Oh, my God! Oh.
Carl ran inside the cabin and found the grieving man with his wife's body cradled in his arms, rocking back and forth.
Joanna!
Robert looked frantically around the ransacked cabin, but his wife was not there. Hoping with all his might that he would not find a second corpse, he lit a lantern with trembling hands, and he searched the cabin again, but he found no sign of her. There was no doubt in either man's mind that the cabin had been visited by Indians. Robert tried not to think about what fate his wife might have suffered. With Carl still lost in grief, Robert went outside and searched all around the cabin and the corral. There was no sign of Joanna. The Indians had taken her. When he went back inside, he found that Carl had managed to pull himself together. He laid Sarah's body gently back on the floor and looked up at Robert.
Joanna?
Robert shook his head slowly.
We've got to find Joanna.
Carl got to his feet.
We've got to find my daughter before they kill her, too.
Well, we can't go after him now. We can't track him in the dark. Can't even see which way they started.
After a sleepless night, morning finally came. Neither man was skilled at tracking, but the trail the Sioux left from the cabin was obvious even to a novice. It led down into the floor of the valley where it turned to the west. They were encouraged to find no evidence that the party had stopped soon after leaving the cabin, giving them hope that Joanna was still alive. In the late afternoon, they lost the trail at a fork in the Beaver River. Searching in a circle that encompassed the two forks, they failed to find any tracks other than their own. By the time darkness descended upon them, they were forced to admit that they had no idea where the warriors had taken Joanna. Grief-stricken, they went through the motions of making camp, neither man with much to say to the other, knowing they had failed, and helpless to do anything to alleviate their despair. Despondent and defeated, they started back to the cabin to bury Sarah Steiner. After leaving the Platte 3.5 days behind him, Clint Connor lay flat on his belly at the top of a long, low ridge. His horses waited behind him farther down the slope, where they wouldn't be seen by the small party of Indians passing to the west, some 75 yards from where he now lay. They were not the first he had seen. Some were in large parties, and all seemed to be heading in the same general direction, toward the Powder River. It was the reason he had decided to ride farther to the east as he made his way north. He had managed to steer clear of the other Indians who had crossed his path, but he had almost blundered into the group he now watched from the hilltop. It was 3 men and a woman, he could now tell, as they reached a point closer to him. The woman rode slumped forward.
Looks like she's sick.
As they came even closer, he realized that the woman's horse was being led by one of the warriors. While Clint watched, the warrior gave the lead rope a sharp yank, causing the woman to grab onto the horse's mane, for there was no saddle under her. As she raised her head, Clint recoiled, startled. Her hair was raven black, but her face was white.
A white woman?
He noticed that her wrists were tied, as well as her ankles beneath the horse's belly. She was a captive. He would have to try to free her, but how to do it was the problem to be worked out. He was accurate enough with a rifle to get one of them, maybe two at this distance, but then he ran the chance that the other one would escape with the woman, and if they were fired upon, they might kill the woman and then run. They had guns, but he couldn't tell from that distance whether they were repeating rifles, single shot, or shotguns. At any rate, they were armed, and they outnumbered him. He felt pretty sure his best chance to get all three of the warriors was to wait until they made camp, and then go in under the cover of darkness. He slid back away from the top of the hill, and he went to get his horses. Because of the open terrain, he was obliged to stay well behind the party as he followed them, often losing sight of them and relying on his ability to find their tracks. It was not always easy, owing to the numerous old tracks that intermingled. It led him to believe that the Sioux and probably the Cheyenne were gathering for some reason, and that equated to more trouble for every white man. He squinted up at the sun, trying to determine how many hours remained before nightfall. With no notion of where the big congregation of Indians was to take place, he just hoped the three he followed would make camp before joining the rest of their brothers. If they didn't, there was little chance he would be able to help the woman. He could not fight the whole Sioux Nation. The last hours of sunlight had faded away before the Indians came to a river where they made their camp. Clint wasn't sure, but he guessed that the river was probably the Belle Fourche. When certain they were stopping for the night, he settled for a dry camp in a shallow ravine where he could wait for darkness to cover the prairie between the two camps. It was not a long wait, but it seemed long. Most of the time was spent at the head of the ravine, watching the glow of their campfire. Finally, the glow softened as the flames died out. Still, he waited until he felt reasonably certain they had retired to their blankets for the night. Checking his rifle once more, he decided it was time. A rough guess told him that the camp was approximately 300 or 400 yards distant. Leaving his horses, he started walking across the open plain toward the tiny glow in the cottonwood trees along the riverbank. As he came closer, he brought his rifle up before him, ready to shoot at the first sign of alarm. There was no cry of discovery or discernible motion of any kind. The camp was still. Shifting his gaze from the horses back to the sleeping forms around the embers of the dying campfire, he searched for the form of the woman. At first, he could see only three bodies. Then he spotted the woman, bound hand and foot and tied to a tree near the horses. Satisfied that she was out of the line of fire, he quietly walked into the camp, his rifle ready before him. The short, gap-toothed warrior sat up, childlike in his attempt to brush the sleep from his eyes. A .44 slug smacked into the warrior's chest. Clint leveled his rifle to take care of the other two. Joanna Becker lay still, terrified by the abrupt explosion of gunfire, her mind a maelstrom of conflicting thoughts. The suddenness of the grim executions by the dark figure, now methodically prodding each body with the toe of his boot, caused her to fear that more trouble was to come her way. Evidently satisfied that all three were dead, he walked in her direction. She couldn't help but cringe against the trunk of the cottonwood. Clint stood over her.
Are you all right, ma'am?
The tone of his voice calmed her fears at once. She relaxed.
I think so.
In truth, she was not certain how bad the many cuts and bruises on her face and body were. Her captors had not been gentle with her. Some of her abuse she vowed never to speak of to anyone. All that mattered at the moment, however, was that she had been saved. He knelt down to one tire.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saving my life.
I'm glad it happened on you.
They killed my mother. My husband and my father, are they looking for me?
I don't know, ma'am. Like I said, I just happened along.
He removed the last of the ropes from around her ankles and looked her over as best he could in the darkness. It appeared that she had several cuts on her arms and shoulders, and her face was badly bruised and swollen beside her left eye. His heart went out to her when he speculated on what she must have endured at the hands of her captors.
Can you walk all right?
She nodded.
I expect it might be a good idea to leave this place. We can go downstream a ways till we find a better place, and we'll see about taking care of some of these cuts.
The site the warriors had chosen to make their camp seemed to be a common crossing of the river, and considering the number of Indians he had seen during the last several days, he thought it best not to take the chance of being caught with three dead warriors.
There you are.
He helped her to her feet and watched her to make sure she was all right.
I prayed to God to either send me help or take my life.
He really didn't know what to say to her. He had compassion for her, but words of consolation didn't come easily to him.
Well, you're all right now. We'll get out of this place and get you something to eat. Fix up your cuts. I'll just see what we can use as far as guns or cartridges go, and take a look at their horses.
One of those horses is my father's.
Yes, ma'am.
He left her standing there while he took an inventory of the Indians' weapons. After a moment, she followed him as he examined an old Henry rifle. She stood gazing down at the cold features of the broad-shouldered Sioux warrior after Clint moved on to pick up the shotgun beside one of the other bodies. After a couple of moments, she looked around her and found a large rock the size of a loaf of bread. With tears gushing forward again, this time in unbridled fury, she held the rock up as high as she could. She slammed it down with all her strength in the warrior's face. Hearing the sound, Clint turned to see the woman glaring down at what she had just done, her fists clenched, her face drawn in anger. Realizing that he was staring at her, she turned to him.
That shotgun belongs to my father.
Right.
He paused briefly by the third body, seeing nothing of value beyond an early model Remington single-shot rifle. He moved on to get the horses. He thought about keeping all four of the horses, but decided that he didn't want to herd the extra three. He did decide, however, to take the opportunity to trade the prison horse for one of the Indian ponies, a paint, deeming it a definite upgrade. Taking one of the Indian saddles, he put it on Joanna's horse.
It might not be the most comfortable saddle, but it'll beat riding bareback.
After witnessing her final farewell to the broad-shouldered warrior, he was a little reluctant to touch her, but she willingly accepted his hand and helping her up in the saddle. Then he led her horse back to retrieve Rowdy and upgrade his pack horse. Following the dark riverbank downstream, they rode for over an hour until Clint selected a deep gully leading down from the bluff. In a short time, he had a fire going, and coffee was not long after that. There was little he could do to fix her wounds, but she insisted that all she needed was to clean them and wash herself in the river. Once she had finished her bath and dried with a blanket Clint had taken from one of the warriors, she seemed content to warm herself by the fire. Clint handed her a cup of coffee.
Get you a little something to eat, then we'll catch a couple hours sleep before sunup.
She merely nodded in return.
What's your name?
Joanna Becker.
All right, Joanna. My name's Clint Connor. Where's home? Where did those Indians grab you?
I don't know exactly. We have a cabin on a stream back there in the hills. My husband and my father were working a claim, but I don't know how to get back there from here. They killed my mother. I know my husband's looking for me, but I don't know how to get back.
Never mind. We'll get you back home.
He sliced two generous slabs of bacon from what was left of the side he had taken from Clell Ballinger's supplies and dropped them in his frying pan. As he tended the sizzling meat, he glanced up at Joanna. With the firelight flickering upon her swollen face, he decided he might have been wrong about her. When he first found her, he thought she was a little older. But on closer inspection, He decided she was not much older than he was. It was just the battered face that misled him.
Don't worry. I'll get you back to your husband, safe and sound.
By the time they had finished the coffee and bacon, there were not many hours of darkness left. Clint gave Joanna a blanket to wrap around herself and made her a bed with his saddle blanket and an oilskin slicker. When sleep finally came, it captured her completely, fueled by total exhaustion.